This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
Well, it's great to have with us this morning Mr. Charles Burris. Charles is a high school history teacher. I must say, the kind of history teacher that makes you want to go back to high school and take a look at his wonderful blogs on lourockwell.com. He's famous for his book lists on amazon.com. Charles, it seems to me that you know about every history book there is, or rather, certainly every history book that people ought to be interested in, rather than the sort of history that we're taught in the public schools, or for that matter, in colleges and universities, or by the media. So if one wants to dispel the clouds that are induced in our brains by the government and all its adjuncts on the question of what's actually happened in the past, who the bad guys were and the good guys were, where do you start?
Well, thank you, Lou. There's just such a wealth of information out there, and Jeff Rickenbach, in his new book on revisionist history, has just really laid out an incredible groundwork of what people really should look at when they look at history, that it's a constantly evolving discipline with new truths coming into view all the time. And it's just fascinating, fascinating.
And certainly they never seem to require any consistency of themselves. I mean, they're always fomenting in the media and the government against conspiracy theories. Except unless, of course, it's Al-Qaeda. Then you have to believe in that particular conspiracy. On the other hand, you can't believe there might have been a conspiracy involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Well, this country was really born in the idea of conspiracy theories. If you read one of the most distinguished historians of the American Revolution, Bernard Bailyn at Harvard, where he talks about most of the founding fathers had this idea that there had been this series of usurpations that continued from administration to administration, from minister to minister in the king's cabinet, and they just saw this long train of abuses that continued, and, you know, a conspiracy, so to speak, and that was what eventually led to their worldview that necessitated a revolution.
Well, if one wants to learn more about the Kennedy assassination, you wouldn't start with trying to read the Warren Commission or Gerald Posner in his synopsis of the Warren Commission. Where would you start?
Well, there's just so many excellent books. I've only got a small collection of myself, I think around 50. And there's this fairly new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, that I've got online that's supposed to be here later this week. But just some of the marvelous work of researchers like Peter Dale Scott, or some of the early critics of the Warren Commission that led up to the groundswell of support by the public for the House Assassinations Investigating Committee in the 1970s. And a lot of good work came out of reactions to that. There's just a wealth of...
I remember loving Mark Lane's books. Do they still hold up in your view?
Yeah, I think he was really pretty much on target. I think, and this is something with my students that I used to focus a lot more on. Now I have to, because of just the volume of history that we have to cover, like with my world history classes, we start with the birth of civilization in ancient Sumer and Mesopotamia, and then we end up with the war in Iraq. So it goes full circle from the beginning of civilization to the attempt to eliminate civilization.
And, of course, where the U.S. Army has been busy destroying the artifacts of ancient Babylon, putting their camps directly in the places that would wreck the archaeological evidence.
Barbarian hordes is the only way to look upon it. Basically, what I try to do with my students is develop what I call critical literacy. Albert J. Nock used to refer to it as a disinterested reflectiveness, a search for the truth, to get beyond a lot of the nonsense. And basically, the very first day, very first thing I tell them is to question authority. Question why, tell them what they see on TV, particularly what they see on the Internet, anything they read. Find out the truth for themselves, and don't just be satisfied with one source. And go for the meat of the subject, the real question that's being asked, and find out the truth for themselves.
Well, Charles, if you're looking to find out the truth, let's say about all of America's wars, have they ever told the truth about any American war, that is, in terms of getting America into the war and in maybe covering up their misdeeds after the war. Is the official story ever true?
No, it's never been true, and that's one of the things of being an old history teacher. You just see, you know, history repeating itself over and over and over, and you would think that finally, you know, somebody would wake up and see just a little bit of precedent here, that this is what people have been constantly been told since War of 1812, and, you know, the Mexican War with the duplicity there. And even Lincoln at that time as a congressman saw through that. And then, of course, later with the War for Southern Independence and Fort Sumter and his deception about that, and McKinley with the war on Spain. And as you say, it's on and on. And I go over that constantly with my students, trying to develop this critical insight, this critical look at beyond the official story, to look beyond just the account that's given in their state-mandated textbooks, which is just, you know, always glorifying government, that, you know, government's always the herald of progress and human liberty, and not really talking about the struggle that has gone on for thousands of years for people to obtain their rights, to obtain their freedom, and that small space of liberty in between themselves and the Leviathan state.
Charles, is it me, or is the propaganda getting stupider, or are the American people getting stupider, or is it just that it's, I mean, what it, it I must say the propaganda, for example, for the Iraq War, the Afghan War, and various other things they're doing, has just impressed me as not very persuasive, but yet it does seem to persuade. Is it that, are people intimidated? Are they actually persuaded? What do you think is going on?
I think there's a little bit of both, but also people are caught up in this mindset of being cheerleaders for the home team, and, you know, they're giving these sort of artificial mascots to root for, and, you know, told that, you know, with the case of the Iraq War, that we were the embodiment of everything that was good, and that you were coming over here to dispel our notions of freedom, you know, and attack the Twin Towers, and I would point out to students, but it wasn't the Iraqis that did that. And there's been, even years later, there are still so many misnomers, so many myths that have been fed to these poor kids for so long, that's basically what I try to do is dispel one myth after another and have them on their own, through this critical intelligence that I try to cultivate and enhance, to find out the truth for themselves.
Charles, I went to school before Vietnam in terms of high school, and one of the things that we were all taught was that America's never lost a war. I always think of it, this is the guerrilla pounding, the government, the guerrilla of government pounding its chest, and, you know, I'm number one. But I always used to point out that, of course, the U.S. lost the War of 1812. They burned down Washington, D.C.
Exactly. And the way I approach teaching history of my students is basically through showing them a series of films. Like my world history kids will probably watch 80 films,
wow,
documentaries, 80 films, and I basically am their Socratic guide through these films, giving commentary and pointing out things that while they're taking their notes and then writing their evaluative essays. And, you know, they'll eventually start forming patterns and seeing the big picture while they're watching these films. But there's one film in particular that addresses exactly what you were talking about, the Academy Award-winning film on Vietnam, Hearts and Minds. There is a classic scene in the film where a returning prisoner of war, Lieutenant George Coker, goes before a parochial class, and I'd say they're probably about third graders from their age. And it's really sort of ironic because he opens his remarks by saying that, you know, someday you might have to go fight a war, and this is how it is. And judging by the time when the movie was made and the age of the kids, they were exactly the age probably when the first Gulf War and the early 90s happened. But a kid asked Lieutenant Coker, you know, how'd you feel when the war was over? And he said, oh, it was so great. We fought so long and so hard to finally win that war, and we were just so delighted to win the war. Well, you know, I put the video on pause, and I asked my students, did we win the war in Vietnam? And they say no. And I said, does he have the right to go in and lie to these little third-grade kids? I mean, look at the faces on these kids with this look of just awe and reverence to this man in uniform who was just flat out lying to him. And then they ask him about what was Vietnam like. Well, if it wasn't for the people, it'd be a great country. which is like someone asking me, you know, what is it like to teach at your high school? I said, well, if it wasn't for the students, it would be great, you know. And it's just one lie after another with his little presentation there. And, you know, every time I show that particular film, I see the little light bulbs light up over their heads that, you know, here's just a real obvious demonstration of someone in a supposed role of authority just lying to them in the most bald-faced, arrogant manner.
And, of course, there's never any estimation of the other side. Great Israeli military historian Martin Van Creveld says that between 4 and 6 million Vietnamese died over the course of that very, very long war. Yet all Americans know about it's, of course, the 50,000-odd names on the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C. They're the only ones that count. The gooks, of course, being subhuman, they don't count.
Exactly. Well, with my students, we try to get the other side. I mean, I give them like an Amazon forest worth of handout materials by people by the name of Mises and Rothbard and Ralph Rako and Thomas Woods. And when we study with my American history students, when we study the Civil War, people like Jeffrey Rogers Hummel or
Tom DiLorenzo.
Well, what I do with Mr. Lorenzo is I, along with these handouts and primary source documents, I show the 11-hour Ken Burns series on the Civil War. And after we watch that, then we watch Mr. Lorenzo's The Real Lincoln series that he did as an antidote. And they're always just very, very delighted with that because of the illuminating insights that he brings to the whole mythology around Lincoln that wasn't covered in the esteemed Ken Burns series.
Because Lincoln really is the founder of the modern American regime, isn't he? I mean, it's not Jefferson or anybody of that sort. It's actually Abraham Lincoln.
I think that's exactly right, and I always make the parallel between what was going on in the 1860s in the United States and what was going on in Europe with Bismarck. Bismarck was the founder of the welfare-warfare state in European terms, and Lincoln was, you know, the precursor of all that here in the United States. And that's really where the world model that people esteem to with the constitutional republic set up by the founders changed to the model of the welfare-warfare state right there. I think that's a critical watershed in the 1860s. And then, of course, also later in the United States during the Progressive Era, which was the forerunner of so much mischief to come.
Charles, as we know, high school kids always seem to make a very worshipful trip to Washington, D.C. Each high school class goes there. I've often thought that'd be a wonderful opportunity for libertarians to have teachers like you and take kids around to some of the monuments and give the actual story of the situation. Tell them what's actually going on at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing as all that money is coming out. Talk about why Abraham Lincoln is sitting on a throne like Jupiter in a Roman temple with the fasces on the front of his throne. Why there's something slightly odd about the fact that Washington is portrayed as a god ascending into heaven in the roof of the U.S. Capitol itself, of course, based on a Roman temple. Why everything might not seem exactly as we're taught in the government schools or by people like Ken Burns on the government TV network.
Exactly. And, you know, I point that out to students that the images and the mythos that goes along with the state and basically what compulsory tax-funded government schooling is all about. And I've always been very frank about that and, you know, why they're there. And if you, you know, trace it back just in America to the colonial beginnings in Massachusetts with the Puritans, one of the very first acts that was passed was the Old Deluder Satan Act. And that was, you know, because of the idea that the idle mind is the devil's workshop and that you have to inculcate these kids with, you know, the necessary skills of literacy so that, you know, all these papists from Europe won't come over, you know, because of their fear of Roman Catholics there in Massachusetts at that time. But it was, you know, from the very beginnings, the whole idea was we wanted a passive youth that knew how to obey, knew how to defer to authority. And it really hasn't changed. It really hasn't changed over the years. And
Charles Burris, I wish that every American high school had a teacher like you who would teach the students about why there's another point of view and why they ought to make up their own minds and exercise, as you say, some critical intelligence and some independent thinking and not be guided like a sheep or cattle into the little corridors that the government would like us all to be in with, of course, so we know what it's the end of those corridors.
Well, thank you, Lou. As you say, I'm trying to teach them to be eagles, to soar above all that and to develop their reflective skills of critical thinking, critical literacy, and independence of mind and character.
Charles Burris, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Lou. The death blow at the time, and they were just so astounded that, you know, people like Paul Krugman and all these others could still resurrect Keynes and these discredited ideas. And I was, you know, basically telling them, you've got to, in this new economy that's coming up, you've got to think outside the box. You just can't take for granted that things are going to be the same way as your parents or your grandparents, and you know, going to college, you know, is going to automatically get you this kind of a job, and you're basically going to have to, in many cases, you know, just be a creative entrepreneur and come up with your own future. And, you know, that's really always been the way I approach my economics class.
Charles, just terrific. That's another podcast.
Yeah.
We should do that. So good. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much again for coming on today.
Okay.
And thanks for all the work you do.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@LouRockwell.com. And thanks for listening.